information.
We have three very interested people present.
Oh, I'm glad.
And a whole bunch of others, too, sorry.
That's great.
Yep, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ed Fogels. I'm the director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting within the Department of Natural Resources. And I have a presentation for you that is a condensed version of the presentation that we've been taking around the state and giving to public forums. And we've done several of those around. It's a condensed version. The one that we give to the public actually takes about 2 hours and involves about five or six different agency people. And this one, I've actually condensed it to closer to an hour.
Yep. Yeah, and we need the Friday afternoon version.
Exactly, yeah. And I may have to go a little faster, too. So, okay. And again, when I give it, typically we wait for questions and answers to the end, but for the committee, your wish is my command. So yep. If you want to stop and ask questions at any time, you know, feel free.
Okay.
In any case, you know, we're going around the state giving this presentation because there's an awful lot of activity, and this is simply a map that shows the various projects in the state and their various stages of permitting, pre-permitting, or operation. And I won't really bother to go through them all right now unless you guys have specific questions on particular projects. I will point out, though, since this is the only time in the presentation it comes up, is there are a couple of Canadian projects that are on the map, and the state's large mine team is monitoring the Canadian projects as well, because those are in drainages that flow into Alaska waters, and we've made a commitment to try and protect our fisheries and water quality resources, and the Canadian government has let us sit on the project team as full participants on those projects.
Okay, Ed, stand by. We now have a quorum with Senator Wagner, Senator Stevens, Huggins, and Stedman. We'd just like to welcome Anchorage, Kenai, Nome, Dillingham, that are online. Oh, Senator Wilikowski's here with us. We got a crowd. And continue on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, the presentation is basically broken out into these pieces. I'm going to first go over the process that we generally use for permitting a major large mine project. We have a little bit of a quick mining 101. We find it's very useful for people that aren't familiar with mining to understand how a mine works and what's important for us as regulators. We'll talk about some of the main permits in a little bit more detail, explain the agencies that are involved, and then typically at our public presentations, the meat of it is always the dialogue back and forth with the public, and we are looking for ways to improve the process. In the presentation, the key concepts that we want to deliver are, our process does not guarantee a yes. We get beat up for that DNR never met a mine it didn't like, and that's not at all true, and we'll explain that. Again, a little bit of mining 101. We want everyone to understand that it's not just a DNR permit that's at stake here and that's issued. As a matter of fact, most of the major permits are through other agencies, and DNR's role is mostly a coordination role. We do have some key permits, but most of our role is a coordination role. So Commissioner Irwin can't just stamp a mine permit approved and be done with it. Financial assurance, we're going to talk about that. That's the pot of money that protects the state's interest. And then you have to understand how experienced our team is, a lot of experience. And then we also do monitoring and inspections of mines that operate. We don't just do the permitting process. Okay, starting with the process, I have to start at the very beginning. How do the mineral rights even get established? Most state land is open to mining. Some state land has been put away in state parks, but in general, state land is for us to manage as multiple use land. The rights are established through Article 8 of the Constitution, and on state and federal land, those rights are acquired through staking, where the prospector goes out and finds something interesting and puts his four stakes in the ground and records that. On private land and Native Corporation, ANCSA land, the mineral rights are acquired through negotiation with the landowner. And then on state land, typically state land use plans sort of determine what's the primary use of state land and can close up to 640 acres of land to mining. Any more than 640, the state legislature has to close that.
Going back to the private land.
Sure.
Private land, the landowner has subsurface rights, or the state has subsurface rights?
With an Mr. Chair, with the Native corporations, the Native corporations have the subsurface rights, so.
But you have Native corporation and private.
And private land. And the private land can vary. I think there is some private land in the state where the mineral estate has transferred to the to private ownership.
Right.
Pardon?
Patented, generally speaking.
Right. And but other private lands, the state still retains that. So it kind of depends on the situation.
Okay.
And then finally, if there is no land use plan in place, then the default is typically that the state land is open to mineral entry. Here's a timeline, a generalized timeline of the mine, the life of a typical significant mine, starting off at the very beginning with initial exploration. And you can see that the permitting phase is right in the middle, and it's typically about a three or so year process. And there are a lot of questions about how long it actually takes us to permit a mine. And I have a specific example I'll run you through later, but a major mine will need to have the federal involvement through NEPA and an environmental impact statement. And it's going to be very difficult for us to permit a mine in less than 3 years, having to follow along with NEPA. And so that would be sort of the low end. At the far end, a major project such as, some of the big ones that have been discussed may take longer than 3 years, maybe up to 5 years.
And your cycle there shows essentially someplace 13 to 15 years before you really go into operation?
Correct. Right. So you have to have typically we find that from discovery of an actual deposit to operation can take like 15 years. So that's pretty typical.
Okay.
And then you can see at the tail end here, the post-closure and monitoring goes on 60-plus years. And as I'll discuss later, some mines may go on monitoring, and our vigilance over them may go on for way longer than 60, maybe forever. This is one of those slides where you're not meant to go through each individual line item, but it's just to illustrate that there are an awful lot of permits that are required for a typical mine project, both state and federal, and sometimes even local government permits. And these are only some of them. And so again, it's not just one permit from DNR, it's a whole slew of permits. I think we counted like 52 necessary authorizations for the POGO project.
Okay.
And many agencies.
And let the record show that Senator Green has joined us and Senator McGuire is excused. Yes, Senator Stevens?
So just trying to roughly go through these. Is there a fish and game permit in this list? I can't see that.
Fish habitat.
But that's DNR, right?
No. Yeah, Senator Stevens, through the chair, at this time, the only permits that Fish and Game would issue would be for special fish and game areas if a mine happened to be in one of those areas, such as some of their fish reserve areas. But the permitting function that was in Fish and Game was transferred to DNR and the Office of Habitat Management and Permitting, and that is what now the governor's introduced the executive order to move it back to Fish and Game. So then Fish and Game will have permitting authority.
Hmm? You want to ask a question?
No, not him. Yeah. I want to ask them a question.
Yeah.
So to cross the T, at this point, there's no Fish and Game permitting necessary for something like Pebble.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Although, as I will mention in the presentation, Fish and Game is very involved in the permitting process. They give us information. They tell us where the fish are, how valuable the habitat might be.
Thank you.
Ed, excuse me for a moment.
Sure.
But since habitat is in Fish and Game, you get the equivalent of that, right? It may not just say fish, but it's about habitat of any of the species. But if I'm wrong, help me out.
Mr. Chair, are you saying the way it is now with
under the new order.
Under the new order?
Yeah.
Under the new order, once habitat moves back to Fish and Game, then yes, Fish and Game will have permitting authority for the fish habitat permits.
Right. That's effective 1 July. Is that accurate?
Okay. That's true. And again, here's the list of the agencies, and we will talk about some of those agencies in a little more detail, but as you can see, it's not just DNR. It's a lot of other agencies involved. And I want to point out that a mine permit application packages can be huge. And this is the permit application package for POGO with a 1,000-page EIS that was done on it. Just to illustrate that that's not just a little form they fill out. It's a huge volume of paperwork. And I can guarantee you the materials that we will get for a mine like Donlin or Pebble, should they apply, will be 10 times that big. I mean, it'll be bookshelves of material.
Senator Wilkowski?
You hear all these stories about things that have happened in the past. In Colorado, for instance, they have that whole big area where there's, I guess, incredibly tainted water that's about to break. You know, they're worried about a dam breaking loose and from mining, and then I think lead water, is it? And then in Minnesota, I read a book recently, Collapse, by Jared Diamond, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Talks about what happened in Montana with the mining industry, and I understand a lot of that happened a long time ago. Have we gotten to the point now where we've corrected all those mistakes? I mean, I just want to assure that those same things don't happen here in Alaska.
Yeah, and that's our job, to make sure those things don't happen again. We spend a tremendous amount of time as a state team studying those past accidents, incidents, find out what went wrong there, making sure that doesn't happen again. A lot of that happened before you had modern environmental regulations in place. People didn't understand. There's a fundamental, and as I'll explain in the Mining 101 section, it's all about water quality and the geochemistry of the rock. And that whole science has evolved tremendously in the last 10, 15 years. And we now know that we have to focus on the geochemistry to find out what the water quality impacts will be long term. And it's not just in a couple months, but in 100 years, 1,000 years, we need to know what those will be. So we're much better at this job now than we ever were. And if you look at Alaska's track record, you know, we have mines that have been going for close to 20 years, and the fish downstream of all our mines are healthier. We have more fish downstream of Fort Knox and Red Dog than there were before the mines were there. So, and that's all being monitored. Okay, and so I mentioned all the agencies. The real biggie is that the federal agencies get involved. And anytime there's a federal authorization, then the National Environmental Policy Act gets invoked. And that means for a large mine, it will be an environmental impact statement. And that is really the driver for the process. I mean, that really is the key. We're almost secondary in some aspects. That EIS process will drive the whole thing. It will take about 3 years, maybe more. And as state agencies, we just plug in on that train and move along with it. And we can't shorten that process. We can just work within the scope of that process. And the EIS is a thorough environmental analysis of the proposed project, and it'll tell you, you know, what those impacts are likely to be. And it's a decision document, so that when it's done, we as agencies can look at that document and go, well, okay, this can work, or no, the impacts are too great. Or the impacts here are too great, so change the project so that it fits within something that's reasonable. And I'm going to run through very quickly an example for you. And this is the Pogo Mine project, underground mine near Delta Junction. And again, just so you know, this was about a 3.5-year process. And we started the agency discussions in 1997. The EIS was actually initiated in August of 2000, and you can see we did public input at the scoping phase early on, and then we did public input at the draft environmental impacts statement phase, and then we actually issued the EIS in October of 2003, and all the state permits were then issued within a couple months of that. So that just gives you a feel for how long a typical process can take. And Pogo is actually a very small, large mine. It's pretty compact, underground, and in the big scheme of things, it's a fraction of the size.
You said it was a small, large mine? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Help me out with that. Is that the inside joke? Or?
No, it's of all our, we often get asked, when do we decide whether a mine is a large mine or not? Mm-hmm. Up to now in Alaska, you have large mines, and then you have mom-and-pop placer operations. There's very little in between, right? And so so we're really working with the major mines in Alaska. And amongst that spectrum of major mines, Pogo is one of the smaller ones in size and impact. Fort Knox has a much bigger impact, much bigger footprint. Red Dog has a much bigger size, bigger impact. I'm not talking about monetary worth or production value. I'm talking about from a sort of an environmental perspective.
Okay. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on the state permits. It says that they were all issued in December of 2003. If you look on the list of all the permits that are required by the state, for example, sewage and air quality and fish mm-hmm. habitat and all that, are those issued one at a time as they're completed, or are they all issued together?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, that's a good question. And as I mentioned, there are an awful lot of permits, the 52-plus permits, right? The ones that are issued in December were the major permits that would allow the mine to start construction. Those are the ones that they're going, okay, we got the green light, we can go. There were probably a dozen or so minor permits that had to follow after that. Some of the air quality permits typically follow after the major permits are issued, because the air quality permits, for instance, you can't really adjudicate those until you get like model numbers on generators and very specific details that the company won't even know until they get the green light to proceed. The major permits are the ones that the corporate boardroom looks at and says, okay, you got the bulk of them done, you know, spend the money, develop the project.
Okay.
Thank you.
And typically in an environmental impact statement process, you've got to do baseline studies. You have to evaluate what the environment is like before the mine goes in. And so here you have a list of typically the list of studies that are done. This is what Pebble and Donlin are doing right now. They're going through and doing all these studies. And those result in reams and reams of documentation for each one of those.
Yeah. Senator Wilkowski?
We're looking, where in the Pebble process would we be? You did kind of that initial time frame piece at the beginning. Where are we in the whole scheme of things with Pebble?
Now let me just run back to it real quick here. So we're in environmental studies. We're probably somewhere, you know, the company hasn't done their feasibility study yet. They're probably still working on this pre-feasibility study, which is a general study that they would do to say, okay, you know, there's a reasonable potential that we can develop an economic mine. Let's spend the money to do the feasibility study, which is a study that they actually take to a bank or to a lender and say, we can do this project and make money, so lend us the money. So we're still way out here. We're the company is collecting baseline data. That's all that's our involvement in the Pebble project at this point. We're helping them to make sure that they collect the right baseline data. And we don't want them to collect the wrong stuff, because then they start permitting and we go, why didn't you find out what fish are in this creek? You know, so we want to make sure that all companies that do business in Alaska understand how to collect the proper baseline data, because it's so critical. And so they're midway through that at this point.
Who's paying for that?
The company is.
Company's
paying for that.
And the time frame that you show in years is, they're about years 5, 6, or 7. Where, can you tell us roughly where Pebble is?
And Pebble in this timeline is probably, yeah, you're probably right, and probably 5, 6, 7. It's a little bit misleading, because the actual initial exploration happened 20 some years ago, and the initial claims were staked 20 plus years ago by, I think they were originally owned by Techiminco or Cominco at the time, and then it was sort of went dormant and no one was interested in the property. So assuming we start our timeline when Northern Dynasty came on board, you know, yeah, you'd be looking probably, you know, about, we're in year, I think I had my first meeting with Northern Dynasty probably about 5 years ago.
Senator Wilkowski.
I think we're all getting emails and calls from constituents saying oppose Pebble, support Pebble.
Right.
What is there going to come a time when the legislature is going to make that decision, or is that just going to be strictly an executive decision? I mean, how do you foresee that process going? I know we're getting a little off track, Mr. Chair, but
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm not sure that I can really answer that. I mean, there are a lot of pieces of legislation before the state legislature right now that could have an effect on Pebble. So a decision could very well be made on Pebble without us doing anything. Their clean water initiatives are out there. That could make a decision on Pebble without us doing anything. So from that perspective, we may not have anything to do here, right? Once, if all goes as planned under the current process, we have a process that I'm explaining to you now that runs through the mill, And it's an executive decision as to whether these permits ought to be issued. Each agency has to decide on their own, you know, can I issue these permits? And if they're all issued, they're all issued.
Ed, I'm going to ask you a question here very quickly. It has to do with a news release I see here that says, judge says Clean Water Initiative unconstitutional, Associated Press. Are you familiar with that Clean Water Initiative?
I'm very familiar with the Clean Water Initiative, and I just read the I just got a copy of the decision this morning, and I haven't had time to read it, but my understanding is that the judge in Fairbanks basically said that the Clean Water Initiative 1 is unconstitutional. Now, you have a judge in Dillingham that said it's good and it should go run its course, so you have two conflicting court decisions. So it's going to have to go to the Supreme Court, is my understanding, and the Supreme Court's going to have to decide with these two conflicting decisions what to do about Clean Water Initiative 1. Now, Clean Water Initiative 3, there's two clean water initiatives out there, and it's very confusing. That's 1 and 3. And 3 is a lot less stringent, and my understanding is that the judge in Fairbanks said that that one's okay to go.
Yeah. And the Supreme Court-wise, based on your experience, when average Alaskan could assume that we would hear something from the Supreme Court on this ruling? If you don't want to go down that lane, that's okay.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't think I could even venture to guess on
good.
That one.
Thank you.
Well after the election, Mr.
Chair. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Please, Senator Stevens, sorry.
I was just going to comment. Ed said that there are several bills out there that might have an impact on this. I was just going to say only if they get a hearing in this committee.
Okay. No.
Bury that thing.
Noted. Now, as I mentioned, the federal process actually drives the whole process, but we go to great lengths with state agencies to plug into the federal process and so that we coordinate. We try and include some of our draft decisions in the draft EIS so the public gets to see everything all at once. All the public meetings are coordinated so the public doesn't have to go to separate meetings for separate different parts of the process. They can come to one meeting. All the agencies, state and federal, will be there to answer questions. And we all kind of been getting beat up lately about a streamlined process, and somehow we're making it quicker and easier and cutting corners. Well, I do not believe that's at all the case. All we're trying to do is synchronize. We're trying to make sure that everything happens together so that the public has a chance to sort of participate in a meaningful way without getting too confused. That's kind of one of the main things that we try and do. And it is a benefit for the applicant, but it is also a benefit for the public, and it's a huge benefit for the agencies in our workload.
Ed, let's do a flashback here real quick and let you talk about yourself. How did you get this job? Why should you have this job? And tell us how long you've had your experience in it.
A weak moment.
Yeah, right. I don't know. Ask Commissioner Irwin. I started working for the state in 1986 as an intern with a division of geological and geophysical surveys. And so I started learning about the mineral potential of Alaska and the geology of Alaska. And then I started working in the lands section of the department and did land use planning and for a number of years. Then I came back and I worked in the coal regulatory program for a number of years, where I wound up managing the coal regulatory program. And at that point, I was asked to start working on the other projects because they were really ramping up. And at one point, it started pretty.
When was that? When you said on the other projects, when was that?
Oh, when was that?
Yep.
95. I believe I started working on some of the other projects, and it started with Fort Knox. I actually didn't work on the permitting of Fort Knox, but when True North was being permitted, that's when Pogo was coming down the pike and Kensington was coming down the pike, and we started realizing we really needed to strengthen our coordination aspect because the agencies were just going nuts. I mean, all these mining projects were coming at them, and there was no coordination, and the industry was just going crazy too because they couldn't get a straight answer out of any one agency. So there is that coordination role kind of started back then.
Okay. And you're at the center of that coordination? Who is at the center of that coordination role?
Well, I'm the director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting, and our job is to have the coordination role within the state. Okay. And we have mining coordinators that are on my staff. Right. that are assigned to each project. So each mining project, oil and gas project like Shell Exploration has a coordinator assigned to it. Transportation projects, Kibada, the railroad extensions have a coordinator assigned to them. And so the job of these coordinators are to watch all the agencies, control the state agencies so they sort of speak with, you know, in a coordinated fashion and work with the federal government.
Okay, so. Good. Thank you.
And then I just want to mention, too, that every state permit has some kind of public process loop. And so even though everything's coordinated, all those comments have to still be evaluated by each individual permit and authorization and then are taken into account.
Okay.
And then very briefly on POGO, just some of the public participation. It's pretty extensive. It starts off, I mean, we're doing a lot of public participation for Donlin and Pebble right now, even though the permitting hasn't started. And that's speeches like this, public meetings. We're outreaching to NGOs and tribal groups. Once the EIS starts, that's when the formal public process begins. You've got scoping, and you have public around. We'll have a round of public meetings for a project like Donlin and Pebble. You know, I almost shudder to think of all the public meetings that we'll have on all the villages out in the region. And there'll be three rounds of those, basically, well, two rounds for sure. Well, the scoping and the draft EIS will have a round of public meetings. And then at the final EIS, there's also a public comment period that doesn't always have public meetings associated with it. And then the federal government requires government-to-government consultation with the tribal governments. And so we typically piggyback as the state onto that effort so that we're, you know, really outreaching to the tribal entities in the region. And again, as I mentioned, every authorization has its own set of public comments associated with it, even though we might ask for them all at once.
Senator Stevens?
So you're recognizing the tribes as governments?
No, we're talking to them. The federal government recognizes them as governments. We as a state, that's a little unclear at this point, and I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer that, but we use the federal government's government-to-government outreach as just a vehicle to talk to those tribal entities in more depth. That's simply our role, to make sure that they're heard.
Senator Green?
Are those meetings called government-to-government meetings?
They are, because they are formally a part of the federal NEPA process. And the federal government is required to have those. Well, actually, they're required to offer the process to the tribal governments. Tribal governments don't always accept it, but if they do, which now they almost always will, then the federal government is required to formally communicate with each tribal government, offer them the opportunity to communicate on a government-to-government basis.
And, Mr. Chairman, and I understand that on behalf of the federal government, I would be very concerned if the state is acknowledging that
for themselves to be involved in, quote, government-to-government talks, mm-hmm. or relations. And I think it should be made very clear that that's not what we're doing. Thank you.
Senator Green, through the chair. Yeah, I understand. And
thank you.
And then we're always open for discussion with the public. We try and improve that any chance we can. Now to the infamous question of, do we ever say no? Yes, we say no many times. It's not as simple as that, though. As I mentioned, a lot of permits. Each permit typically will have several or if not many yes or no decisions within that particular permit. And so when we get an application, we'll say no to a particular component of their application, and the company has to go back and redesign it. And so there's this kind of a loop. The dam, we may say, you're this component of the dam, the liner system, it's too flimsy. Yeah, we're not permitting this. They'll go back. They'll come back later with a new design with a thicker liner system. Mm-hmm. And that goes on until finally, you know, if the company can afford it, making that thing thicker and thicker, you know, eventually we may very well say yes to it if it meets our standards.
Yeah. And if I might, I'm going to ask you to give us a 30-second burst on Kensington here for a moment.
Sure.
But as I read the newspaper and listen to accounts from multiple sources, it appears that there is strong support within the Juneau community for Kensington Mine. There's huge investment, obviously a large labor pool demand, and on and on and on. And it appeared it went through a process and then somehow got derailed when everybody thought it was kind of, quote, going to go. Can you just give us a 30-second burst on what transpired there?
Mr. Chair, it'd be tough in 30 seconds. It's an awful long story, but there was always a lot of opposition by the environmental groups on the method of tailings disposal, which was to put the tailings into a lake, an alpine lake up near where the mill site was going to be. The agencies reviewed that, and it was a choice. The permitted option that the company already had permits, and they had received them many years before for a whole different mine plan. And they decided that mine plan was just uneconomical. They came back with a new one that required a whole new EIS. The originally permitted project had a dry stack tailings facility, and I'll explain a little bit later what a dry stack is, but 160 acres of disturbance on the other side of the mountain, and quite a bit of wetlands there. And so the new proposal was to put the tailings in a lake, in a natural lake, that was about 12 acres in diameter or in size, and or maybe it was 20, I'm sorry, I'd have to check on the actual size. But
sure.
In any case, the agency's job was to evaluate the relative environmental merits and weaknesses of each proposal. And what the agencies decided was that it looked highly likely that under the Slate Lake's tailings disposal option, that lake could be restored post-closure into a lake that had as much productivity as the original one, if not more. And biologists, the agencies were all convinced that could be done, and that was part of the weighing process. So we permitted the Slate Lakes option. There is a bit of a legal conflict in the regulations between the Environmental Protection, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, and the Federal Army Corps of Engineers that created sort of some ambiguity about the legality of putting those tailings in the lake, and that's what the environmental groups challenged, and they won in the Ninth Circuit. And so the company has now gone back and has worked with the environmental groups, those same environmental groups that brought the suit, and they've come up with what we call Plan B, which is actually to go back to the dry stack and build a smaller, newer, kind of a different tailings facility. And the environmental groups and the company have all both agreed they can do this, and now they're working with the agencies to permit this Plan B.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Senator Stevens.
Well, it's interesting semantics about do we ever say no, because I understand your point that sometimes you say no and then it comes back with a change and the projects change. But so the question is, do you ever really say no? What's the last project that you really said no on after it was all said and done? Mm-hmm. And how can we give us a number of 100 projects in 10 years, 50 were no?
Well, Senator Stevens, through the chair, keep in mind that there are only five operating mines in Alaska right now that we've permitted over the last 20 years, right? So we haven't had, it's not like we're getting hundreds of these things every year to decide on, right? The AJ mine went through a big, long, rigorous permitting process that the company finally gave up on. And I think maybe I should just do a couple more of these bullets, because it's important to note that sometimes the applicants will abandon the project before we even get to the final parts of the permitting process, because we've said no so many times on certain aspects, they finally go, you know, we can't afford to do this. We're walking. And that is a part of the reason, as we understand it, why the AJ project was abandoned. The Ryan Lode project up in Fairbanks was never undertaken by Fairbanks Gold for similar reasons. The permitting requirements were too strict. So, and also the last bullet is, I think their applicants won't even bother to apply because they'll look at the permitting requirements and they can already see they're going to be too strict, and they can pencil it out and go, this isn't going to work. So typically when an applicant applies for a permit, they've done enough homework to know, okay, you know, this is doable. If we can meet clean water standards, if we can meet these requirements, we should be able to get our permits. And that's the assumption going into a permitting process. The companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars working on the project before they submit a permit application. know, and we've been working with them in advance of that to give them ideas like, you know, don't even try and go there. I mean, that'll never be permittable. We can have those kinds of discussions with an applicant beforehand. So when a $100 million permit application package lands on our desk, the company's got to, you know, they're reasonably confident that they've got something that should be permittable, and they've looked at the laws and looked at the regulations. So our job's to go through that and look for weaknesses, and if it's an allowed use there, you know, we're trying to sit there and let the company know what is permittable and what's not. That's the best way I can answer that, Senator.
Senator Wolakowski.
So just kind of tagging on that question, though, and to use Pebble as an example, because that's, I think, the one that's on everyone's mind, it really comes down to cost. There'll be a permitting process, and you'll say, okay, well, we want that liner to be thicker, and maybe it'll cost a couple hundred million dollars to do that, and we want that dam to be of a certain substance. That'll be a couple hundred million dollars for that. If the company can afford to do it, you generally say yes. Is that a fair statement?
I mean, that's probably a pretty fair assumption. I mean, Senator Wolakowski, through the chair, the technology is there to protect the environment on these mining projects. It's just a matter of, can the company afford it?
And so with a prospect like Pebble Mine, which is now, I just read, worth maybe $500 billion, mm-hmm. there's probably a pretty good likelihood that's going to get permitted.
You know, Senator Wolakowski, through the chair, I mean, the company hasn't actually submitted their applications. And so there could be permitting obstacles that are so expensive that even a $500 billion of value won't overcome. And there's also the risk factor. They could just encase that whole thing in 6 feet of stainless steel and put a glass bubble on it, and just seal it up tighter in a drum. But at some point, it will be even too expensive for the owners of the Pebble project if we're not assured that those impacts can be addressed. And for a project that's located in a sensitive location like Bristol Bay, those liners are going to have to be that much thicker. And, I mean, the risk we're going to tolerate is going to be way lower for a mine in a sensitive location than maybe somewhere that's not quite so sensitive. And there are also other impacts with a project that maybe can't be mitigated with money, the visual impacts. You're not going to be able to put a tarp over Pebble and hide it. It's going to be there. It's going to be a visual impact. The impacts to the region of having 1,000 employees working there, a road going in there. In my conversations with some of the local government officials, that's what they're really concerned about. Actually, the late Dan Salmon, who died the other day in a plane crash, told me just at the Pebble hearings that he's convinced that the environmental stuff could be handled. It's the other impacts that he's worried about. A road, the increased hunting pressure, the increased fishing pressures, those are the huge impacts that people are going to have to really look at to get a handle on. But I'm not sure if I answered your question. Or,
thank you. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to run through.
Repeat that. You were saying the environmental stuff can be handled. It's the other stuff like
population.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I think it's the population changes, the use patterns in the area. Those things, you know, if you have a workforce of 1,000 that are living out in that region, how are they going to get there? Are they going to fly in and out like at Red Dog? Are they going to build, is Iliamna and New Halen going to build up? Those are the kinds of questions. Where's everyone going to hunt? Are you going to have new roads being built in the area? Those are the questions that I think that some of the local government officials have really been asking. What will happen to the region?
Thank you.
Senator Stedman?
Oh, I just, in reflecting on those comments about what will happen to the region when we create employment, we create communities that can afford to operate as communities, and we improve our tax base. I think a good example is to look at Southeast Alaska when the timber industry came in. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen to our fishing? What's going to happen to our hunting? What's going to happen to our schools and our power? Well, we have more deer. We have more salmon. We have hydroelectric capacity now. We have more roads. We have better schools. We have communities that are self-sustaining. And that industry has moved on, unfortunately, the two major pulp mills. But in their wake, there was a lot of economic good that was left behind to increase the standard of living for the region of Southeast Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting you mentioned that, because I actually hunt out in that area and fish some with a rod and reel. And in talking to the local people, there was two or three things that I heard them say that was appealing to them. It had nothing to do with the mine other than maybe some jobs for families or friends. First one was power.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it would bring power generation. The second was just the cost of commodities, because you would have a road that would lead around that you could bring things in versus barging up large items or flying them into Iliamna or Port Allsworth or you name the location. So it was interesting to me to listen, because, I mean, quite frankly, the road infrastructure between Iliamna and almost to Non-Dalton is pretty good.
It's really good.
And, I mean, you can't get all the way to Port Allsworth, but there are people do it in the wintertime, by and large, by snow machines. But I was surprised at how receptive, at least the people I talked to in and about some of the communities. But there's a great sensitivity to the business of fish and survival of fish, which we can all respect. You know, for those people that are big hunters, the caribou population and the distribution of caribou, they've sort of left that area, and the numbers have dwindled dramatically from, I don't know, 300,000 to maybe 50 or 60,000. So that's not a historically a large moose concentration area because of the habitat, but there are lots of fish.
Mm-hmm.
There are definitely lots of fish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, these mines have tremendous potential to contribute to the economy of the region. There's absolutely no question. You can see that in Red Dog. It essentially funds the Northwest Arctic Borough. Fort Knox is a tremendous economic contributor to the Fairbanks area, and any of these other projects could do that to a huge level in their region. There's absolutely no question. And they are already. The Donlin exploration and the Pebble exploration are spending a lot of money in the region. A lot of the people have big paychecks now from that exploration.
Yeah, and you know, I can only speak for myself and just set aside the mining part of it, but it was part of a mining operation that brought the concept. Well, I think it was Red Dog, to be quite frank. But describing how when they first came and started hiring people, how high the turnover rate was based on sociological difficulties, and after having programs in place to address them and listening to some of the people involved, how much a difference they had made as far as the sociological impact factors that caused people to quit, not come to work, or whatever the case may be, and how successful the workforce appeared to be. That's the most telling thing I've heard in this building that I'm proud to have heard.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, yeah, and the Donlin workforce in and of itself is a stunning story there too. Almost 200 people working on that exploration project, and if you ever get a chance to have some of the Barrick folks run you through that story, it's pretty spectacular. They went through a huge turnover rate, and no one could pass the drug and alcohol testing. Now it's almost a 100% pass rate, and almost all their managers are from the local villages. They've done a really good job, and that's
it
the way it really.
It was Donlin. I stand corrected. It was Donlin.
It was Donlin. Yes. Okay. It's great. Okay, y'all ready for just a real quick mining 101? I can breeze through this very quickly. I know it's late on a Friday, but you know, the three basic types in Alaska of mining. You got placer mining, which are usually the typical, the mom and pop, the smaller operations. You've got underground mines like Greens Creek and Pogo, and then you've got the open pit mines like Fort Knox and Red Dog. I don't mention, I don't go into coal mining here in this presentation, but coal mining is essentially kind of a third. It's a strip mining, but I'm not going to touch on coal mining unless you guys want to go there. But here's a picture of the Fort Knox project, and essentially the miners are going for the ore, and the ore is in discrete bodies in the rock, and it's surrounded by waste, and that waste has to be removed. Sometimes that waste has got some metal in it that can be put aside and maybe mined a little later, but essentially they're just They're just going for the ore bodies that have been delineated by drilling. So here's a little schematic. You got an ore body under the ground. You have to take the waste rock out. Where do you put it? You put it in a pile, next to the pit somewhere. What do you do with the ore? You take it to the mill. You put the ore in the mill. It gets processed. Now, I'm not going to go into any details on the processing, on cyanide, on any of that stuff in this presentation, unless you want to delve there. I can go there. But essentially, out the bottom end, you get your gold bars, your metal concentrates, whatever you're after. But in doing that, you have more waste products. You have tailings. Tailings are the waste products that come out of the mill. And typically in Alaska, they're either disposed of one of two ways. They're either compressed and filtered and the water is squeezed out, and they're stacked up in a dry stack tailings fashion, which is just a big pile. And because they're dry, it's more stable. And that's very much more expensive to do that than it is to do the other method, which is to slurry the tailings through a pipe behind a dam and put them in what's called a wet tailings impoundment. And typically on top of the wet tailings impoundment, you keep a layer of water to keep the tailings wet. In some instances, that keeps them from oxidizing and releasing harmful
Senator materials. Wagner and Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, but while you're talking about that, just so we have it right, explain what happens to that wet tailings.
Mm-hmm.
Because they eventually compact and dry out also.
They do, absolutely. They do. Tailings are very fine. They're consistency of flour. So when those tailings are pumped into this impoundment, you might have seen some ads. People that aren't happy with Pebble show a wall of water coming at them, And typically, this is even probably exaggerated a bit. Typically, the water layer on top of a tailings impoundment is very thin, maybe 20 feet. Sometimes it can be as little as a couple feet. The tailings will compact over time. They'll settle and consolidate, and they get pretty impermeable when they're 10, 20 years down the road. They'll compact, and there may be some water that comes out the bottom from the pour water will come out the bottom for a number of years, but at some point those tailings could very well consolidate to a point where they're actually a impermeable liner that's maybe hundreds of feet thick. The mining company has to show us all the details. They have to show us studies about the tailings, what they're going to do over time, and what the chemistry of those tailings is going to be. But it's also entirely possible, if you have a really large mine that's going to generate a lot of tailings, you can split the tailings into good tailings and bad tailings. And so you can take the good tailings, which are essentially clean, maybe just totally clean, no possibility of ever releasing any bad water, and you can line a good part of your tailings impoundment with those, a couple hundred feet. Then you can start putting your bad tailings in cells in that, and you can design a system that theoretically would contain those bad tailings very handily. That stuff all has to be engineered out, and a tremendous amount of technical details is put into designing those, and also on our end to review that kind of thing. Now, I should say that no one's really designed a tailings facility like that in Alaska, but they have been designed that way in other parts of the world, to my knowledge. So, and I'm going to get into the chemistry in just a minute, too. Senator Wilikowski
answered it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me just carry on. Just again, three basic waste products that we have to deal with. Waste rock, net tailings, dry stacked, and wet tailings. And what we're really concerned about here is the geochemistry. What's in that rock? Because when rock is ground up, it's going to weather faster. And if there's some chemicals in those minerals, they're going to leach out faster if they're ground up than if they're in a solid form. Because remember, all you're really doing is taking the natural rock here, and you're grinding it up, and it's either going to be fine tailings or maybe coarse waste rock, right? And so that's going to accelerate weathering and leaching of anything undesirable in there. And so both the tailings and the waste rock there's a wide spectrum. And when you look at the geochemistry of the waste rock or the tailings, the stuff can be clean as can be, with no danger of ever leaching anything out, or it can be really reactive and pose really serious problems. Examples of that are Fort Knox, is essentially a granite body that that rock is just granitic, and it's clean, and it very low chance of ever releasing any kind of acid or metals leaching. Not very low level of worry there. Red Dog, the waste rock and the tailings are very reactive, and when you put those waste rock piles somewhere and the rain percolates through, it'll start picking up the sulfuric acid from the weathering of the sulfides, and that in turn will release metals, so you have bad water coming out of those piles. And so the mining company has to do extensive sampling, and I'll go into briefly how they do that.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski has a question for you.
I went up to Red Dog this summer, and I was very impressed with what I saw. But by the way, we always read in the paper about how it's the most toxic mining site in the United States. And so I guess two questions. Number one, are we doing what we need to be doing up there?
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's number one. And number two, what about the dust that comes,
dust.
The potential for toxic dust?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the first question, are we doing what we need to be doing up there? I believe we are. The stories that you read and that claim of it being the most polluting mine in North America, that stems from the Environmental Protection Agency's toxic release inventory. And it's very important to understand how they define a toxic release. When they move rock from the pit at Red Dog to the waste rock pile, they move 100 tons of rock. That 100 tons of rock is counted as a toxic release. And that even the waste rock has huge amounts of lead and zinc in it. And so all that lead and zinc in that waste rock, those 100 tons, that's just moved within the mine site, is counted as a release. That's why those numbers are so huge. That's not actually pollutants that are getting out into the environment. That's just rock being moved from one place in the mine to the other. And if you look at the EPA's website, they don't even call it pollution. And so when you hear claims of it being the biggest polluter, that's, I mean, that word pollution is not even used in that EPA's database. So that's really the essence of that whole toxic release inventory database. And that's why it's so misleading to say that that stuff's just getting out into the environment. It's not. They move a huge quantity of rock there, and that's all counted as a release. That whole mine site is ringed. Any water leaving that mine site is captured and treated and is regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. And we have studied the fisheries downstream of the Red Dog mine ever since that mine went into production, and there are more fish downstream now than there were when that mine started, mainly because the natural waters that were flowing over the hillsides there were running over mineralized areas that were so mineralized that they were killing off the fish and keeping the fish from coming up the stream. So, and we're testing those fish, we're testing their tissue samples, and we have reports that we can get you that document the fisheries downstream of Red Dog, Fort Knox, Greens Creek, and can show you that fish are happy.
Dust?
Pardon?
Dust?
Oh, the dust issue, yes, Senator. There has been a dust problem at Red Dog, absolutely no denying it. When the mine first went into production, no one realized what a problem the dust would be. The dust is basically generated from the concentrate that the mine produces, which is essentially very concentrated ore, almost pure lead and zinc dust. So so a lot of that concentrate was getting on the wheels of the trucks. The trucks were pretty crude. They had tarps on them. They're barreling down the road to port 50 miles away. A lot of stuff was getting off. And there is an issue. There is dust, lead and zinc contamination of the tundra alongside of the road, which, you know, decreases the further away from the road you get. The problem has been recognized. The company bought a whole new fleet of trucks with big sealing, hydraulically sealing lids. They've got truck washes. We're in a process right now. We feel, as agencies, very comfortable that they've done a huge amount of good in reducing those dust emissions. I mean, really knocked them down. As to how much, we're doing a lot of monitoring to find that out. They may still have to do more, but the problem is nowhere near as bad now as it used to be. The real problem we have now is we still have contaminated tundra, and we have to find out how to deal with that. And the agencies are still working on the best way to remediate that contaminated tundra. So yeah, there's no question. There was an issue there, and we've done our best to rectify it as agencies, and companies spent a lot of money to try and rectify it, but it's an issue. And again, it's still there as far as contamination in the tundra adjacent to the mine and along the road.
Okay, Ed, continue, please.
Okay. So again, we're trying to find out what the geochemistry is, and not going to bore you with the details, but You know, we test these rock samples, hundreds and hundreds of them for each mine site. We plot them on these graphs. Basically, acid generation is a huge deal, and there are some minerals in a rock that can generate acid, and there's other minerals, such as carbonates, that can consume acid. And if a rock has equal amounts of acid generating minerals and acid consuming minerals, that's a one-to-one ratio. Theoretically, all the acid should be consumed by the other minerals, and in this graph, those rocks would plot along the one-to-one ratio line right there. So theoretically, anything that's over on this side is potentially acid generating. Anything over here is potentially non-acid generating, and that's important to us because the company can then identify which rocks are which, and the non-acid generating rocks can be used for road construction. Don't have to worry about them so much. The potentially acid-generating rocks have to be treated specially, put in special places, special measures to make sure that water doesn't, in the long term, get into the environment. We have other tests. These are called humidity cells, where we actually, well, we don't, but consulting companies will put rocks in these big columns, and they'll percolate water through these columns for, here's a graph. It's 100 weeks. This one's a 103-week-long test. Long-term tests to get an idea of what the long-term potential is for these rock types to release bad water. And that gives us as agencies a good sense that we understand what the chemistry is. And that's really what designs a mine from our perspective, right? The companies got their own design issues with economy, but from us, from an environmental perspective, the chemistry tells us how the mine should be built, how the tailings pond should be built. Again, these pictures are from Red Dog. You can see that these are the waste rock piles at Red Dog. And all that water will percolate through, and it's collected by ditches here. It's either into the tailings pond, captured in there, or transferred by ditches to the water treatment plant here, where it's treated before it can be released. So none of that water can escape the mine without reporting to the treatment facilities there. And again, treatment facilities, there's all kinds of technology to treat anything you want to. Again, it's just a matter of cost. You know, the dirtier the water, the more expensive it is to treat. And we won't go into the details here, but there's a picture of the water treatment plant at Greens Creek. And then, why are we doing this? In the old days, you've got legacy issues, Spain and Pennsylvania, bad water. They didn't understand this back in the old days. We do understand it now. We're a lot better at it. We may not be perfect, but I guarantee you we're definitely a lot better at doing this now than we were, you know, even 10 years ago. Okay, now we're going to hit the permits just briefly here. Here's just a list of the main state permits. They're in your handout. I'm going to touch on a few of them in a little more detail, but I'm not going to go through all of them. I'm going to start with DEC, since DEC may have one of the most significant permitting roles. They are the ones that their waste management permit actually permits the waste facilities, the tailings pond and the waste rock piles. And that's the permit that says we understand the water quality impacts potentially in the long term from these facilities, and we approve your design. That's the purpose of this permit. So it is probably the number one permit that we help DEC, but Commissioner of DEC is ultimately responsible for making sure that this permit is issued properly. Other DEC permits, I'm going to talk about the NPDES permits here at the end, but that's the federal permit that actually lets you discharge water. And it is a federal permit issued by the EPA, but our DEC has to put its stamp of approval on that as well through a certification. As they have, this DEC also has to approve the Army Corps of Engineers wetlands permit. We'll talk about that a little more in a minute. There's just a list of the other permits that DEC issues, and I'm going to keep going unless anyone has a specific question. The Department of Natural Resources has to approve the reclamation plan, and we have regulations that say that the mine has to be returned to a stable condition compatible with the post-mining land use. If it's state land, that means it has to be compatible with what our land use plan says. If it's private land, the landowner, you know, gets to determine what they want their land use to be. If they want to flat and build a Walmart there, that's up to them. You know, that's what they want their land use to be. That's their prerogative. Our job is to make sure the state's resources are protected, critters and water quality, and air quality. Financial assurance. Now I'm going to talk about this. This is really important because this is the monetary mechanism, and I'm going to talk about it here with the reclamation plan, but it also applies to a lot of the other permits within the permitting system require what's called financial assurance. It's sometimes called bonding. We don't use the word bonding so much anymore because that's actually a certain type of financial assurance. Financial assurance is just a financial mechanism that assures that the state of Alaska has the money to clean up the mine if the company cannot. If it goes bankrupt, we can go in there, we can reclaim it, clean it up, and we can take care of water quality issues in the long term. I'm going to go into just a bit more detail on financial assurance here in a minute, but this is a slide. Illinois Creek is a gold mine out near McGrath that, here's a picture of it shortly after closure. They recontoured the rock dumps and here's vegetation on it. It's just, the vegetation is taking hold. It's stable. It's not eroding. So reclamation can be done properly. It's a science. If you think it out, it can be done. It can be done wrong, too. So financial assurance, the company has to come into us and explain to us how much it would cost me at Fogles to reclaim the property should they go away. They give us detailed engineering analysis. It's hundreds of pages of spreadsheets, line item by line item, down to pounds per grass seed, cost of grass seed to revegetate, the rental costs for every type of equipment needed, fuel costs, labor costs, everything is costed out in these spreadsheets. And we have to go, we have mining engineers on staff that can go through this line item by line item and make sure that we agree with this. What is it when we settle upon a number? What do they actually give us? used to be surety bonds; those are very hard to get now. Almost all of our financial assurances in Alaska are letters of credit with third-party major financial institutions. So it's an agreement between the company and the bank that if they bail on their obligation, the bank has to cut us a check.
Yeah. Senator Wilkowski.
So with Red Dog and that situation you talked about with the dust,
mm-hmm.
Are you using the reclamation money that Red Dog put into this bond to force them to pay for that cleanup? Or are they being required to pay for that cleanup in some way?
Senator, through the chair, at this point, the idea is for them to clean it up. We're not, we would only have to deal with this issue if the mine closed and Techcominco went bankrupt and left the scene. At this point, the cleanup, the dust, that's their issue and their responsibility to clean it up and pay for it.
So are they doing that? I mean,
well, with Red Dog, they will be. The agencies right now are trying to figure out how best to clean it up. We don't quite know how best to clean that tundra up. I mean, at the extreme, you can just tear it all up, haul it off, and incinerate it. All right, but then you've got these huge swaths of mud. That are going to be really hard to revegetate. So is that the best way to do it? We don't have the answer to that. It may be that it's best, that's going to be an industrial road for, 60 some years more. It may be shown that over the years with rainwater that those metals will just leach into the ground and it won't be an issue. We don't have an answer for that question yet. But ultimately right now it's the company's responsibility to whatever course of action is decided upon, that will be the company's responsibility.
So if I could just follow up. So Red Dog, I assume, went through this, really massive permitting process, and still this happened. And, I mean, are there other things that you're not catching that are happening out there that we need to be concerned about in the mining world?
Well, Senator, through the chair, A couple of points. One is that Red Dog was permitted 20 years ago, and that was a long time ago. If we were to permit Red Dog again today, it would be a whole different process. I just want to make sure that's really clear. Back when Red Dog was permitted, that was before the statutes were in place for reclamation bonding even were there. So Red Dog is complicated. We like to say there's nothing simple about Red Dog. We've been working for over 4 years with Techcominco because Red Dog was permitted before there was a reclamation statute in place, they actually don't have a really good reclamation plan in place right now. We've been working for 4 years to develop a reclamation plan with a company, and we're very close to finishing that off. And so we're sort of retroing Red Dog into it. I firmly believe that if Red Dog were permitted today, it would look a lot different with under today's laws, regulations, and with our expertise.
Go ahead, Ed.
Oh, let me just go back.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wagner.
While you're on that, I get a lot of statements and emails and everything, just so the public that's watching here today, explain letters of credit, because a lot of people have the idea that if the company goes broke or leaves Alaska, that letter of credit doesn't stay with the mine, but it does. And would you explain how that works?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. The letter of credit essentially binds the bank to provide the funds to the state of Alaska should the company not be able to live up to the requirements of the reclamation plan, right? So the company goes away, well, for whatever reason, it's just between us and the bank. The company's no longer part of the deal anymore. It's between us and the bank, and our main job is to make sure that that bank is a major financial institution that's licensed to do business in the U.S. So they cut us a check. They have the resources to cut us a check for that amount. So it stays there. It's the purpose of that is to protect the state if the company should disappear.
Yeah, and Ed, in that respect, let's assume for a moment there's an operating mine. I mean, it can be any mm-hmm. mine. And you discover or it's reported to you that there's, quote, an operational difficulty. How long does it take the state to react to that, number one? And number two, what's at your disposal to react to those kind of situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, it kind of depends on the mine and what the problem really is. I mean, every mine, and actually, it maybe it goes back to a question that Senator Wilikowski asked, maybe I didn't answer fully. No mine is perfect. We're always, the company's typically coming up with problems at the mine. We find problems, and we're working with the mine continuously to make course corrections, to fix things. We do mine inspections as often as we can. We try and get out there at least quarterly to most mines, more if there's an issue going on. We do inspections. The mining staff are very familiar with each project and can walk around there and look and go, okay, you know, there's a problem there. Now that looks okay. So, you know, if a problem comes up, we'll be on it right away. And if it depends on, again, what the threat to the environment is. Some problems may not pose a threat to the environment. We'll let the company take, you know, longer to fix those. If it's a threat to the environment, you know, we got to do something about it right away. We can close the mine down. We can issue stop orders, and shut the place down if we think that there's an imminent threat to the environment.
Yeah. Senator Wilikowski.
So the total amount of bonds you have in the entire state is $278 million, which is a sizable amount. But when things happen, I imagine they're probably on, potentially at least, on the massive scale. And, I mean, what would happen if, again, let's say Pebble Mine, there were leakages into the Quechac River or one of the main big trout mm-hmm. fisheries out there, and it caused $1 billion worth of damage, lost fishing. Do they pay for it? Does the state, who pays for that? How does that work?
Well, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, again, the bond that's in place is for us to be able to shut down the existing operation, reclaim it, and make sure water is treated. We can only bond so much if we have to bond for a total catastrophic failure, then in all likelihood, that bond would be of the amount that we wouldn't have any industry in this state. At some point, you know, we won't be able to cover every possible eventuality. There's no way. I mean, we approach it from what are the environmental protections in place at the mine site to prevent something like that from happening. And typically, what you'll find is it's the monitoring ring around the mine that lets you see when problems start developing. Very rarely are they the dam splits and everything washes downstream. Usually it's something is not quite right with the dam, and there's some seepage in a place that you weren't expecting it, and the monitoring picks that up, We go on site, we work with a company to say, this is what we think you ought to do. Company does it, and there are things you can do to correct that. So the idea is to watch it closely enough so that problems, you catch them when they're very small. And that really is the name of the game. But if a project absolutely, you know, if it was a catastrophe on the scale of Exxon Valdez, then, you know, there won't be a financial assurance in place ever to cover the state for a catastrophic event like that. I mean, if you required that, then you'd probably really, no one would be able to afford to do business here.
Go ahead, Ed.
Okay. Just a real quick note, too, about the trust fund. And there are actually two parts to a financial assurance. One is to do the dirt work and put the place to bed even in the immediate term. And one is to take care of the water treatment. At Red Dog, right now, we believe, and the company believes, that you'll have to treat water at Red Dog forever after that mine closes, right? So they've got a water treatment plant there that costs $4 million a year to operate. We're going to have a fund in place so that fund, the interest from that fund, will fund that water treatment plant, plus contingencies and unexpected items and whatnot. So that's part of what state law also allows us to have as far as a financial assurance, to set up a trust fund to take care of long-term obligations. Dams will typically need them. The Kensington permit for the Slate Lakes had a dam in place, even though that's probably not going to get built now. There was $1 million trust fund set aside for that, so that the interest from that would pay for maintenance and inspection of that dam. And then financial assurance applies equally to U.S. and non-U.S. corporations. We keep getting beat up over the Canadians and the Japanese, you know, that aren't liable by our environmental laws. That's not true at all. I mean, they're just as liable to our laws as anybody else. And the financial assurance is it doesn't care where the company's from. It's ours. It's secure. We can get it.
Okay. Senator Stevens?
Yeah, thank you. I understand that in terms of a mine within Alaska, of course, on the map you showed us right back to the start, there are a couple of mines that are actually in Canada. Are you comfortable that Canadian laws are similar enough to ours that we're protected the same way we are? You can protect the environment and the population and the fisheries and all that just as much in Canada as we can in the United States?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, we've taken a look at the Canadian laws and regulations and their water quality standards, and we're comfortable that they're as good as ours, and in some places they're probably even stricter than ours. Even given that, we're still watching them to make sure that we are comfortable with the way these things are designed. I mean, they have a lot more mining going on in British Columbia than we do here, and have for a long time. And so, you know, they have a lot of experience with these projects. So, yeah, we're comfortable.
Yeah. Let me add in that respect, Senator Stedman and Senator Wagner wasn't with us down in Alberta. It was interesting to me the reclamation they were doing there, and they were actually using the same surface terrain to put back in place. And because of the prairie grasses that were growing there, they were bringing in buffalo and actually reintroduced the herds into there. It was very interesting and very thorough. I was impressed with it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. And the Alberta mines, the oil sands mining there is more akin to coal mining, which is sort of strip mining where you dig your first hole, you take your coal, your oil sands out, you put that dirt somewhere, then you dig your second hole and you put it back into the first hole, you dig your third hole, put that dirt back in a second hole, and you sort of march along. And you can kind of recreate the contours to be similar to what existed there before. I mean, no way you can replicate it 100%, but the name of the game in coal mining and in strip mining is to sort of try and recreate a natural landscape that, you know, I've been to reclaim coal mines in the lower 48 that, you know, I'd buy a cabin there in a heartbeat if I could, you know. I mean, they're really beautiful and have reclaimed really well. So reclamation is a science and it's engineering. It can be done properly. Also be done wrong. There are an awful lot of examples of poorly done reclamation. So
Ed, you got 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, fine. Okay. I think I talked about how the amounts vary with long-term obligations, water treatment. We review bond amounts every 5 years to make sure that circumstances haven't changed, fuel rise. We do an environmental audit, which I have a slide in a minute. I'll tell you what an environmental audit is, but message is we look at the bond amounts or the financial assurance amount at least every 5 years to make sure they're still realistic. And here's just a list of all the bonds in the state. I won't go through those other than point out that Red Dog is the biggie. And we're still actually in process on that one. That's an approximate number that the company ponied up for. And we're going to finalize that whole plan here in the next year. And that number is likely to change. Probably will go up. Just a picture of the Fort Knox project. Just a note that as far as reclamation goes, they started reclaiming even before they really started mining some old tailings down in the creek below that was mined by historic placer mining activity. And they built a freshwater reservoir that the plan for the Fort Knox downstream areas are to provide a recreation area to the community when the mine is done. So the reclamation plan can be far-reaching. It could actually go so far as to offer something back to a community if all the pieces fit in there.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
I know you're short, a short yep. time, but will the pit be used? Because I seem to remember hearing something that would be part of the reclamation plan to become a lake and
correct
recreation area.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, yeah. Within the Fort Knox reclamation plan, there will be a lake. It'll take about 70 years for that lake to actually fill up. But it'll be a big lake. And depending on how the rock walls, some of the rock walls will still be above the pit. And it's granite, so the rock is pretty solid. So if it's determined that rock is pretty solid and safe, that could be a real, that could be a recreational body of water. And so that's potentially in the cards. It depends on, if you start having a lot of rock coming off those cliffs, it may not be safe, but...
Thank you.
Yeah. Dams. Every mine has dams, in just about, and either for water supply or for tailings. And part of DNR's job is we have a dam safety engineer that certifies all dams, whether they're mining or not, in the state. And it's an engineering exercise, and there's a lot to it. There's seismic standards, and as I mentioned, there's financial assurance that's required. Here's just a cross section, kind of an engineering cross section of a typical tailings dam construction, just to illustrate that it is an engineering exercise. Everything has to be stamped by professional engineers, and every detail is engineered out. And here's just some of the concerns that are important in the dam evaluation. Where is it? What's below it? What's the hazard potential? What's the geology? The earthquake risk in the area? How strong you have to build that dam? Hydrology, how much water are you going to want to put behind the dam? What's the flood event? Is the dam going to overtop? making sure that the dam is solid. What's going to happen? Every dams are designed to leak. They have to leak because otherwise the water will build up within the core of the dam and destabilize it. So it has to pass water. So where does that water go? What's the water quality? Where does it show up? What do you do with it when it comes out the other side of the dam? Those are all questions that have to be answered. And then operations and maintenance, it has to be taken care of for as long as it exists. You can't walk away from it. And then, of course, emergency contingency planning. Just a couple pictures of the Fort Knox Dam up here, and then our dam safety engineer, Charlie Cobb, going down to inspect the construction of arrays at the Red Dog Dam. Title 41 permits, these are the ones that are issued by DNR's Office of Habitat Management and Permitting that will soon be the Department of Fish and Game's Office of Habitat Management and Permitting, or whatever it will be called there. Essentially, permits are required for any work in fish-bearing waters. So dams, if a dam's going in there, if you're going to restructure one or reroute one or mine through one, you need a Title 41 permit. Here's the remaining major authorizations from DNR that I'm not going to go through in any great detail, but there's a lot more to it, and I could spend another hour running through these things with you. But as I mentioned, monitoring is key. Every mine has to have a monitoring net around it that monitors all aspects of the environment, and that is so important that we understand. That way we can catch problems as they start to develop rather than wait for something catastrophic to take hold. I mean, groundwater in particular. got to monitor that groundwater. When you see stuff picking up in the groundwater, there's a problem, alarm bells go off, we find out what it is. You can put interceptor wells in, you can pump that water back out, treat it, you can put more monitoring wells in, you can adjust and flex that system to take care of problems. And then, as I mentioned, every 5 years we go in and we do an environmental audit of the mine site. And not only of the mine site, all environmental systems at the mine are audited, but also agencies are audited. They audit us to find out how well the agencies are performing. They're done by third-party experts. Put it out to bid. It's usually some big environmental engineering firm like HDR or Golder sends in a team of 15 people, and they'll spend close to a year auditing a mine and the agencies, every aspect of it. Produces a nice, big, thick audit. Public information, we've got a bunch of them for Fort Knox. That requirement is new to Red Dog, so they're going to just start their audits. Pogo is just getting ready for their first audit. Greens Creek, I believe they've gone through about two audits so far, so, or they're maybe on their second one. But and then financial assurances are a key part of that audit. It's going to tell us that because experts will say, no, that's not enough money. You need to amp it up, and then we'll amp it up. Getting close to the end. Agencies involved, should be no surprise to you. Those are all the agencies. Within DNR, you've got the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Habitat. I've talked about them, Office of Project Management and Permitting, and the newly created Division of Coastal and Oceans Management to do the coastal zone reviews. DEC's three main divisions of water, air quality, and environmental health are all involved. Fish and Game, even though they may not have authorizations to issue now, their people are still involved to provide us information, and we work very closely with them, so they are not, they've never been out of the loop. And then, to turn back to the large mine permitting team, this is actually, the team derives from this statute that puts DNR as a lead player in the coordination of large mining projects in the state. There's actually a companion statute to this in the duties of the commissioner that puts DNR as lead for all resource development projects, but this is the one specific to mining. And so we've created a team that was essentially created back in the Fort Knox permitting days, and it's been the same core group of people that have been working on these mines, some close to 20 years now. A lot of experts, a lot of PhDs, master's people that have really a lot of expertise. And I can't overemphasize that. I see so many times that outside experts are coming in to advise at hearings and wherever, but you as legislators need to understand that these are your experts. I mean, take advantage of them. They're really good at what they do. You need more information on anything, please, we're more than happy to give you all the technical advice on any particular component. We've got really good people working on the team that have a lot of experience. We've got hydrologists, geologists, engineers, environmental scientists, just across the board. Someday I'll like to tally up the years and all the degrees, and I'm proud of the guys. And in addition, if we don't have the expertise, we'll hire out. And we do that quite commonly. When we run into a wall in our expertise, we'll hire a third-party expert to advise us. And almost every major project, we've hired someone to, for example, advise us on geochemistry, because that's so important. We want another set of eyes to make sure that we see it the way we see it. The team also conducts the inspections after it's permitted, so we're not out of the loop. And we're involved from pre-permitting to post-closure. So it's a good group of people that all work for you guys. And this last point is pretty important, and it's also fairly controversial, but all of our costs are billed back to the project applicant. We have MOUs with every mining company that we're doing work with, and we bill them every 6 months for all state agency time that's incurred to that particular project. I think I have probably about $1.2 to $1.3 million sum total in MOUs that I have that runs my budget and the budget of all these other agency people and other agencies. That's money that you guys can spend somewhere else, you know. And so we get beat up on that a lot, that the companies are paying our salaries, but, you know, the system has worked. And the fact that they agree to pay our costs does not guarantee that they get issued permits, and that's stipulated.
Yeah, how do
Just real briefly, because I know you're pressed, how do Alaska's tax structure on mining stack up against other jurisdictions?
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we're actually in the midst of trying to put that information together for some of the for the bill that's before the legislature on that. I think that it's there are some states that have higher tax rates and some that have lower. And so I'm not really at a position to give you more details than that, other than you know that the payback to the state is increasing now, and mining is a very unique industry. It's different than oil and gas. It's very capital intensive up front. So you know, a company typically doesn't make profits on its operation until many years down the road. When if you look at Red Dog now, the profits are going through the roof, and we are up to $170 million in I think state taxes and revenues just 2006. So it's
Senator Wagner, question.
yeah, and talking about that, there's a difference between where the mine's located and whose land it's on and everything. Let's say Pebble, that's on state land.
Right.
That was set aside by the state for mining, et cetera. You never notice it. But if that's state land, what type of royalties does the state receive off of that land when it comes to mining? Just that section of the, I know there's other taxes, and corporate. And,
right. Senator Wagner, through the chair, on a mine on state land, you'll have the 3% royalty, which is on net profits. You'll have the mining license tax, which, boy, I think that's up to 7%, and then the corporate income tax, which is 9%, I believe. So those are the three main taxes that are taxes and royalties that would be levied on the Pebble project.
But that's only 3% on net profit.
Right.
So the oil companies pay 25% on net profit, and the minings pay 3%, and we've got a mine there that's now projected to produce $500 billion. I sometimes wonder if that seems like a fair and equitable share for the state to receive from that, I guess.
Faces.
Senator Stevens.
We love those.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Faces.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I've learned a lot, I think. One of the things I keep hearing, and I know we keep referring to Pebble, but from somebody I have a great respect for, saying that in Pebble, the one issue that he has the most trouble understanding how it would end up is the dam. And I think experts would say that is a critical issue. Yet you have told us and showed us a slide that would imply that it's a fairly benign thing, that there's solid stuff at the bottom and a little bit of water at the top. I guess my question of you is a catastrophic earthquake damage to a dam, is there any way that it would, I mean, would it be benign on the river system below it, or could it be damaging to the resource of Bristol Bay?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, you know, you cannot really answer that question until you see what the mining company proposes to build. It is technically possible to build anything given enough money. The dams are going to be a huge concern on the Pebble site. Some of the areas where they propose some of the dams have many hundreds of feet of glacial till or overburden on top of bedrock. So it's always best to build a dam and key it into bedrock. If you can't reach bedrock, then you've got some kind of permeable material between the dam and the bedrock, which is a conduit for seepage. Now you can place grout curtains, which are slots full of concrete and other materials, pretty deep now with technology. It's very spendy, and again, that technology is improving by the day. So by the time Pebble, maybe they submit their permits, I don't know when, they may have some solution to really show that they can drop a grout curtain to bedrock and seal it up. We really don't know. But, I mean, I think you're correct in saying that, I mean, that is a big concern. And as regulators, we're going to be looking at that very carefully. And we That's the one area that we look at and go, wow, you know, that's going to be really challenging to figure out a way to design that.
So just to follow up, is that material benign, or if it got into the system, could it be dangerous?
Well, again, we don't actually know that yet. It could potentially be benign. I mean, there have been some discussions that perhaps the tailings could be split apart to where 80% of the tailings are very benign and then 20% are reactive. And those are just wild numbers, but some big number of benign tailings, some little number of reactive tailings. You could design you could conceivably design some kind of tailings facility where the reactive tailings are far enough back, like a mile back behind the dam, to where even if it cracked wide open, you know, those reactive tailings wouldn't escape. But without seeing the actual designs, you know, I couldn't tell you whether that would actually work or not. The concepts are there, and theoretically, you know, you could design something that could very well work. But the challenges are huge, and it may very well be that it can't be done. And, you know, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to want to permit that thing if we have any doubts of a catastrophic failure that is going to jeopardize the salmon fishery of Bristol Bay. And the governor's made that real clear, and sure, any future governor would probably say the same thing, too.
Okay. Further questions or comments? Ed, thank you very much. Be diligent. Take the rest of the day off.
Thank you very much.
Could we meet on Saturday?